Welcome to the Dep Dive.
Today we're tackling something huge in medicine, really a topic that's been buzzing for years, the arrival of gene therapy for hemophilia.
That's right. It's been hailed as this potential holy grail, hasn't it?
Yeah.
A single gene disorder seems like the perfect candidate for a cure.
Exactly. But our mission today isn't just to repeat the headlines. We want to get into the weeds, look at the ethical questions, the practical hurdles, you know, what happens when this scientific dream actually meets clinical reality.
Mm-hmm. We're going past the initial miracle reports to explore things like, well, what does cure even mean here? And what about the side effects, the patient experience? It gets complicated.
It really does. And to get why this is such a big deal, maybe we should start with a bit of history. Hemophilia isn't just any disorder.
No, it's got this famous, almost infamous backstory, the royal disease, they called it.
Right. It affected Queen Victoria's descendants across Europe, England, Germany, Russia, Spain. Three generations plagued by this X-linked condition, the lack of factor VIII or factor IX causing severe bleeding.
And the most famous case, probably, is Tsarevich Alexei Nikolaevich Romanov in Russia. His short life was just dominated by these awful, dangerous bleeding episodes.
Yeah, and the story gets even stranger with his treatment or attempted treatment by Grigory Rasputin.
Oh, Rasputin.
Yeah.
His methods were, well, a real mix. On one hand, he told the family Alexei shouldn't have aspirin.
Which is fascinating because that actually lines up perfectly with what doctors say today. Avoid NSAIDs because they increase bleeding risk.
Exactly. Pretty insightful for the time. Then you have the other stuff. Intense prayer.
Yeah.
Sound therapy. Hypnosis.
Definitely not standard of care anymore.
Not quite, no.
So let's jump forward because the way we manage hemophilia now is worlds apart from Alexei's time or even from, say, the 1960s.
Oh, absolutely. Back then, life expectancy for severe hemophilia was maybe 20, 30 years if you're lucky.
But now, at least in countries with good resources.
It's transformed. Prophylaxis, regular treatment to prevent bleeds using recombinant factors, longer-lasting factors, and critically, newer non-factor therapies like emicizumab, which is just a subcutaneous shot for hemophilia A.
It's made a huge difference. Life expectancy is now close to the general population for many.
It really is. Which raises the question you hinted at earlier.
Right. If current treatments are so good, why the intense focus, the almost desperate push for gene therapy?
Because it always represented the ultimate goal, the definitive fix. Hemophilia was the perfect test case, one gene, easy to measure the outcome, factor levels, and even a little bit of factor makes a big difference clinically.
The thinking was, if it doesn't work for hemophilia,
it probably won't work for anything. Yeah, that was a common sentiment. Huge pressure.
And now it's here. The first products got approved starting around 2022, 2023 for both Hem A and Hem B. So the Holy Grail is technically available.
Uh-huh.
Let's dive straight into that reality check then. How's it actually performing out in the real world or at least in the later trials?
Well, the initial results were often described using words like miraculous. You can see why.
Factor levels shot up.
Yeah, significantly.
Yeah.
Into the mild range, sometimes even normal. Bleeding rates drop dramatically. People stop needing their regular prophylaxis. That's a huge win, no question.
Okay, but there's always a but in these stories, isn't there?
Almost always. And the first big one here is durability. How long does this miracle last?
So the effect might wear off.
It appears that way, yeah.
Mm.
Especially the data coming out for hemophilia A suggests the factor levels tend to decline over time. Mm-hmm. We just don't have that really long-term 10-plus year data yet to know if it's a permanent fix or...
Or more like a long-acting treatment, a temporary cure.
Precisely. That's the concern floating around. Is it temporary?
And it's not even an option for everyone, right? There are big groups who are excluded from the current therapies.
Yes. Significant exclusion zones, children, for starters. It's not approved for pediatric use yet.
Okay.
People who've developed inhibitors, those are antibodies against the clotting factor itself, they're excluded.
Makes sense.
And people with pre-existing liver disease, which sadly affects a fair number of older patients because of exposure to contaminated blood products back in the 80s, leading to hepatitis C.
Right, the liver is where the gene therapy does its work.
Exactly, so liver health is crucial. And then there's the vector issue.
The delivery truck, basically. The virus they use to get the gene in.
Yeah, the AAV, adeno-associated virus. It's generally safe, but many of us have been exposed to different AAVs naturally.
So we might have antibodies already.
Correct. And if you have pre-existing neutralizing antibodies to the specific AAV vector being used in the therapy, which could be anywhere from 15% to maybe even 60% of the population, depending on the vector type.
Then the therapy gets zapped before it even reaches the liver cells.
Pretty much. Your immune system just neutralizes it. So a big chunk of potential candidates are screened out right at the beginning.
Okay, so durability questions, significant exclusions. But what about the people who do get it? You mentioned side effects and hidden burdens. This sounds important.
It's absolutely critical and maybe not discussed enough initially. The main issue is an immune response to the vector itself, which shows up as rising liver enzymes, transaminases.
How common is that?
Very. In some of the big HEMA trials, it was seen in like over 85% of participants.
Wow. And how do they manage that?
With immunosuppression, usually high-dose glucocorticoid steroids.
Ah, so you're trading hemophilia prophylaxis for taking steroids?
Essentially, yes. For a period of time, often several months, to control that liver inflammation. And this is where it gets really interesting, based on patient reports.
What did they say?
We found accounts where patients described the steroid course as the worst part of their trial experience.
Worse than the regular infusions they were trying to get away from.
Worse. Because steroids come with their own set of systemic side effects, right? Mood changes, weight gain, sleep problems, increased infection risk. It's a systemic burden.
So instead of managing bleeding risk, they're managing daily steroid side effects.
Which, for some, felt more disruptive and unpleasant than their established routine of self-infusing factor. It's a really significant trade-off.
And it's a trade-off you make permanently, or at least the decision to get the therapy is permanent.
That's another key point. The current generation of these therapies is basically a one-shot deal.
You can't easily redo it?
Not with the same AAV vector, no. Once you've received it, you develop high levels of antibodies against that vector. So if a better, more durable, maybe safer version comes along in 5 or 10 years using a similar vector,
you might be ineligible for it because you took the first version.
Exactly. You're making a potentially lifelong decision based on current technology, which might only offer a temporary benefit. That's a heavy choice.
Okay, this is really painting a much more complex picture than just gene therapy cures hemophilia. Which brings us perfectly to this idea of the cure conundrum.
Yes. That word cure, it gets thrown around so much.
In the headlines, in the early reports.
And sometimes even implied in research papers. But what does it actually mean to the different people involved? That ambiguity can cause real problems.
Especially when you're talking about informed consent with the patient. If they hear cure, they might imagine something very different from what the doctor or the trial results can actually promise.
Precisely. Our sources highlight this by breaking down cure into three sort of distinct ways people think about it.
Okay, let's unpack those. What's the first one?
The first is maybe the most scientific or clinical view. Cure as normalization of the body.
So measurable results.
Right. Hitting certain targets, like getting your factor levels above a certain threshold, say 5% or 15%, and staying there, needing no replacement factor for maybe 5 years. It's objective, quantifiable. What regulators look for.
Makes sense. But ticking a biological box doesn't automatically equal a cured life, right?
Exactly. Which leads to the second idea. Cure as obtaining a normal life. This is often closer to what patients hope for. It's more holistic. It means achieving what some called a hemophilia-free mind. No more constant worry about bleeding. No more restrictions on career choices, travel, physical activity. Mm-hmm. Just freedom.
Total liberation from the disease's impact on your life.
Yeah, a much higher bar than just factor levels.
And the third way of thinking about cure, you said it was more philosophical.
It is. It's cure as a change in identity.
How so?
It's the idea that living with and managing a chronic illness like hemophilia becomes part of who you are, part of your story. Overcoming it, or having it effectively removed by a therapy, can fundamentally change that narrative identity.
And that could be good. Or maybe not always.
It could be complex. While many would welcome shedding the patient identity, as we'll discuss, the sources suggest that for some, that identity and the community built around it is significant. Losing it might feel like a loss.
Okay, three different takes on cure. Body, life, identity. Given this confusion, what's the practical advice for doctors talking to patients about gene therapy?
Well, the strong suggestion from the research we looked at is pretty radical. Maybe just don't use the word cure at all in that clinical conversation.
Really? Abandon it completely?
In the patient-physician setting, yes. Because the risk of mismatched expectations is just too high. The doctor might be thinking normalization of factor levels, while the patient hears complete freedom and no more worries.
So instead, focus on specifics.
Exactly. Talk about concrete endpoints. What factor level can we realistically expect for how long based on current data? What activities might become safer? How will it impact your current treatment burden? Be precise about the benefits and trade-offs, not the loaded term cure.
That feels much clearer and safer. Okay, let's shift fully into that patient perspective now, because there are some really surprising twists here, especially around independence.
Absolutely. First, it's important to understand the context. There's often immense trust between patients and their hemophilia treatment centers.
It's a lifelong relationship, often.
It really is. Cradle to grave, as one source put it. That trust, combined with a genuine desire to help others, to advance the science for future generations. Real altruism can make patients very willing participants in trials.
Maybe sometimes too willing. Less critical during the consent process.
It's a potential dynamic, yes. Something treatment teams need to be mindful of. But the really fascinating part is this independence paradox.
I found this stunning. The idea that gene therapy, which aims to make you less severe, could actually make you less independent day to day. How does that work?
Okay, so think about someone with severe hemophilia currently. They're often experts at managing their condition.
They know how to self-infuse factor intravenously.
Right. They usually have a supply of factor concentrate at home. If they have a bleed or even a minor injury, they can often treat themselves immediately, right there. That's a form of independence, emergency self-sufficiency.
Okay, got it. So what changes with gene therapy if it bumps their factor level up to, say, mild hemophilia status?
Well, the fear expressed by patients is this. If you're now classified as mild, treatment guidelines might say you no longer qualify for that home supply factor. And because you're not regularly infusing anymore, you might lose the skill, the confidence, to do it yourself.
So if you do have an injury or need surgery or just have a scare,
you can't just treat yourself. You now have to call your treatment center, report the incident, maybe get permission or specific instructions, possibly travel in for assessment or treatment.
You become dependent on the healthcare system again.
In a different way, yes. That quote from a patient really captures it. I don't want to say you're a prisoner, but you're a prisoner of the system. You trade the physical need for factor for a kind of bureaucratic dependence.
Wow. That completely reframes what success looks like. It's not just about the factor number. It's about control over your own life and body.
Exactly. And this ties into that identity piece we mentioned earlier.
The pride in self-management.
Yes. It's not just about managing the disease. It's about mastering it. There's a real sense of competence, even pride, that comes with being able to handle this complex, potentially dangerous condition yourself.
That amazing quote you found really drives it home.
It does. The patient's saying, since I was 12, I inject myself. I can do it while drunk. I can do it on a ship. I can do it in a moving car.
That's incredible skill and confidence.
It is. And the implication is that skill, that mastery, is part of their identity. Losing it, even for a higher factor level, might feel like losing a part of yourself or losing solidarity with the community that shares that experience.
So given all these complexities, the durability questions, the immunosuppression, the potential loss of independence and identity, plus the fact that current treatments like emicizumab are actually pretty good and convenient.
Right. Emicizumab is just a simple subcutaneous injection, much easier than IV infusions.
It starts to make sense why some patients might hesitate about gene therapy right now.
Absolutely. Many patients, looking at the current gene therapy results, see them as offering incremental benefits at best, compared to what they already have with modern prophylaxis.
Especially if that benefit comes with steroids and uncertainty and loss of control.
Precisely. So a lot of patients are making a very rational, strategic choice.
Yeah.
Let's wait and see.
Wait for the next generation.
Yeah. Wait for a version that's hopefully more durable, maybe uses a different vector that avoids the antibody issue, maybe doesn't require such intense immunosuppression. Why jump on the first version if version 2.0 might be significantly better?
It's a calculated gamble, but understandable. Okay, let's pivot to the other massive factor looming over all of this, cost.
The elephant in the room, indeed, and it's a colossal elephant.
The numbers are just eye-watering.
They really are. The first gene therapy approved for hemophilia B had a list price of $3.5 million for a single treatment.
$3.5 million. Yeah. That immediately raises huge questions about access, doesn't it? Who can actually afford this? Is this only for the very wealthy or health systems with incredibly deep pockets?
It creates enormous hurdles. Even in well-funded systems like in Western Europe or North America, getting reimbursement approval for a multi-million dollar therapy, especially one with remaining questions about long-term durability, is a massive challenge.
And what about globally? There were some early hopes maybe a one-time treatment could help bridge the gap between rich and poor countries where regular prophylaxis is unaffordable.
That seems unlikely now, unfortunately. The high upfront cost is one barrier. But also, gene therapy isn't just one and done in terms of care. It requires really intensive long-term monitoring, liver function tests, factor level checks.
Infrastructure that might not exist everywhere.
Exactly. So rather than closing the gap, the fear is that these ultra-expensive therapies could actually widen the global disparity in hemophilia care.
So cost access challenges. This leads to another really interesting concept from the sources. The idea that gene therapy might be creating a whole new way of experiencing this condition, a sort of limbo state.
Yeah, this idea of living in between health and disease.
Yeah.
It's quite profound.
What does that mean, practically?
It means patients might exist in two states simultaneously. On one hand, they're in remission. The active bleeding is stopped. They're off prophylaxis.
Yeah.
But they still live with the consequences of having had hemophilia, maybe joint damage, for example.
Okay. But they're also...
We're also in waiting.
Waiting for the other shoe to drop. Waiting for the factor levels to fall again.
Precisely. Knowing the effect might not be permanent creates this underlying psychological stress.
Mm-hmm.
One person in a trial talked about constantly watching their factor levels.
Yeah.
Every time the number dipped, feeling that anxiety surge. Oh, shift, it's going again.
That's a new kind of burden. Not the burden of bleeding, but the burden of uncertainty.
A constant low-level psychological vigilance. It's a different state of being.
And finally, there's this idea that progress itself keeps moving the goalposts.
Right. As standard care gets better and better, the bar for what gene therapy needs to achieve gets higher and higher.
The therapeutic window narrows.
Exactly. 10 or 20 years ago, just stopping the severe, life-threatening bleeds would have been revolutionary. A huge win.
But now, with treatments like emicizumab making severe bleeds much rarer for many.
Goal shifts. Now, the expectation for gene therapy is increasingly to get factor levels into the truly normal range, maybe above 50%.
Not just mild, but actually normal.
Yes. And the field is even starting to focus on things like preventing microscopic joint bleeds. These tiny bleeds we didn't even fully recognize as a major issue before, but which contribute to long-term joint damage.
So ironically, our success in treating the big problems reveals smaller, more subtle problems, which then raises the bar for what a cure needs to address.
It's the paradox of progress. The better we get, the more we realize needs fixing, and the harder it becomes for a new therapy like gene therapy to be seen as the definitive ultimate solution.
Gene therapy for hemophilia is a monumental scientific achievement. It's moved from sci-fi to actual medicine.
Absolutely. A real landmark.
But the clinical reality is messy. It's complicated by doubts about how long it lasts, the significant side effect burden like immunosuppression, major access limitations, and this fundamental ambiguity around what we even mean by cure.
That sums it up well. The promise is tantalizing, but the current product has real limitations and trade-offs.
Which leads us to that final thought for you, the listener, to consider. If medical progress, like we've seen in hemophilia, constantly redefines what normal health looks like and keeps raising the bar for treatment success,
then how do we make sure our future goals align with what patients actually value? Is the ultimate aim just hitting ever higher biological targets, normalizing factor levels, stopping microbleeds?
Or should it prioritize enabling patients to live life on their own terms? Maintaining that sense of control and independence, what the sources called concordant self-management, even if their factor levels aren't perfectly normal by the latest definition.
It's that fundamental question. Whose definition of success matters most in the end? The biologists, the regulators, or the person living with the condition? Something to think about.
Definitely something to think about. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us today.